Hi, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to talk today, for welcoming me. Thank you very much. What I wanted to discuss today is a little bit of the Sutra Parsha, Parsha Mitzvah, that's coming up in 2 weeks. Basically, every single time when one is learning Torah, there's a rule or an assumption that we always have, which is we always assume that every single story, every single pasuk, every single word is there for a reason and is there to teach us something significant. That leads us to this week's Parsha, where we look at this week's Parsha and we have a question. Before, I meant to say this before, in the source sheet you have an expanded version of this year. For time purposes, to make sure that I am done in the hour, which I'm supposed to do, I'm going to skip some sources as I go along, so if you're up to a source that I don't do, just move on to the next one. When we get to this week's Parsha, we have to ask a question, which is, we have an entire story, and as we're going to read it together in a few minutes, 13 psukim, where we really don't understand why we care about this story whatsoever. It's not about the Jewish people, it's about the Egyptian people, it's about their economy, it's about what's going on in their country because there's a famine. Why at all do we care to hear so many details about this story? Before I can answer my question, which is going to be the goal of our shiur, I need to read to you these psukim so that we understand exactly what we're talking about. So it's going to take a few minutes just to go through the psukim, which is on the first page of your source sheet. I also gave it to you in English. I'm going to read them in the Hebrew and translate it. The psukim begin with psukim that we should have in our text, which is about the Jewish people. Vayoshev Yosef et aviv ve'et achav, vayitein lahem amitzperek mem zayin pasukil. Vayoshev Yosef et aviv ve'et achav, vayitein lahem achuza be'eretz Mitzrayim v'meitav ha'aretz be'eretz Ramses kasher tziva paro. Yosef settles his family in the land, and he gives them a piece of the land, and the good portion of the land, in the land of Ramses, just like Paro commanded. And Yosef supports his family with food for everyone. That makes sense that we should hear this. This is about the Jewish people. Now we move on to our 13th psukim. There's no food in the land because it's such a horrible famine. And the land of Mitzrayim, the Eretz Canaan, are so affected by the famine, it's as if they're like fainting, is the word. So Yosef collects all the money that is found in the entire land of Mitzrayim and Canaan, trading it over, him giving them food and them giving him all the money, and he brings this money to the house of Paro. But the problem happens. What's the problem? People run out of money. There's no more money anymore. Canaan, in the land of Egypt or in Canaan. And the people come crying to Yosef saying, give us food. Why should we die? Because we have no more money. I mean, what are we going to do? We can't pay anymore for this food. Vayomer Yosef, Yosef have no problem, I have an idea. Havu mikneichem, ve'etna lechem b'mikneichem, emeth zaketef, give me your animals, I'll give you food for your animals, because there's no more money. Vayaviu et mikneichem el Yosef, vayitei lehem Yosef lechem v'susim u'b'mikne hatzon v'nike ha'bakar u'b'chamarim v'inahalem v'lechem v'chol mikneichem v'shana ha'hi. So they go and they bring all their animals to Yosef, and Yosef gives them food, and he feeds them for that year. Problem happens again. But Titom Hashana Hahi, the year ends, Vaivo Elabashana Shenit, and they come to Yosef in the second year, Vayomulo, Lo Nechachet Me'adani, we're not going to hide from you. He and Tama Ketep Umikne Habahema, Beladani, Lo Nishar Lef Me'adani, Bilti Imviatenu Admatenu. The money is gone, the animals are gone, we're out of animals, we have nothing left to give you except our bodies and our fields and our land. So what's our idea? We shouldn't die. Why should we die? We'll give you ourselves and our fields, and we'll be slaves to you, and you'll own our land, and you will give us seeds, you will give us food so that we will live, and that our fields will not go desolate. So now Yosef does an extraordinary thing. He buys the entire land of Egypt for Paro. Because the people of Mitzrayim sold to him all of their fields, all of their land, because the famine was so bad. So the land is now Paros. What does he do with the people? He moves all the people from one border, from one end border of Mitzrayim to the other. He moves everyone around, takes everyone out of their land, and moves them to different sections of Mitzrayim. Rafat Masa Kohanim Lo Kana, just the land of the priests of Egypt he doesn't buy. Ki Chokma Kohanim Me'et Paro, because they have a portion of food from Paro. Va'achlu Et Chokam, so they eat their portion, or Shernatam HaParo, that Paro gave them. Ha'kein Lo Machrut Ad Matam, so they didn't have to sell their fields, because they had food from Paro. Va'yomer Yosef Al'am, Hin Kaniti Atzcham Hayom Et Ad Matchem LeParo. Hei Lochem Zeru Zerach Masad Tamai, says, okay. Yosef says to the people, I have all your money, I have your food, I have your land. So now go here, go plant your land, go here is the seed. And here's the condition. When it comes the time of the harvest, since Paro owns your land, one-fifth of anything you grow goes to Paro, four-fifths you get to keep in order to feed yourself and your family. By Yomra, Hachiatanu, they say, you have saved us, thank you, Yosef. Nimsachin be'enei adaniv, ha'inu avadim l'paro, if it finds favor in your eyes, we will be your slaves. By Yasemos tell Yosef, l'chok ahiyom adel, admas mitzrayim l'paro l'chomet, rad admas hakohanim l'vadom l'paro. Yosef makes a rule from that day on, all of the land of Egypt, one-fifth of everything that is grown, all goes to Paro, except for the land of the priests, because Paro doesn't own those lands. Concluding now back to what we should have seen in the story. Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim, the Jewish people are living in Mitzrayim in the land of Goshen. Vayechazu ba, vayechru ve'erbum od, and they get possession in it, and they are very successful. What we have to ask here is, again, I just read 13 psukim about the story of the Egyptians giving over their money, giving over their animals, giving over their land, giving themselves over as slaves. What is the point of the story? Why do I care about the story? Why does the story get so much based in our parsha? Why doesn't it get one pasuk? Or why does it get anything at all? Why do we care about this story? So in order to understand what we can learn from this story, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take four different types of approaches. First, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the structure of the story and try to see if we can see from the structure what we're supposed to be learning out from the story. Number two, we're going to look for clues within the text of the story itself. Number three, we're going to look at the bigger picture of the Yosef story to try to see if there's a theme that is helping us to learn from. And number four, we're going to look at parallel stories throughout Tanakh of stories that seem similar to these stories or the stories of Yosef. That's what we're going to do. Let's start with step number one. If we look at our parak again, which we're still looking at the first page, you'll see that there's a very interesting structure here. And I kind of split it up for you the way I did it on your sheet, which is we have two psukim about the Jewish people, followed by a large amount of psukim about the Egyptians, once again bringing us back to the topic of the Jewish people. Meaning instead of just talking about the Jewish people and then the Egyptians, it is Jewish people, Egyptians, Jewish people. And it creates bookends between the Jewish people and the Egyptians, where the Jewish people are on the two sides and the Egyptians are in the middle. What happens when you have a story that seems to be some sort of bookend? What we normally try to do in a bookend type of situation is we say that we want to compare what's in the center to what's in the bookend. And if you make a comparison between the two, the comparison is amazing. Right? We have the Egyptians who are giving up everything. They have no food and they're starving. They're giving up their land. They're giving up their animals. They're giving up everything. On the other hand, we have the exact opposite situation going on with the Jewish people. We have the Jewish people, if you look again at Pasuk Yudbet, which I read already, that Yosef is 100% supporting them. He's not charging them money. They're not paying anything to get the food. They are getting the food for free. On top of that fact, we have a much huger difference between the two, which is if you look at, again, both of the bookends, we have the same word that comes up twice. In Pasuk Yud-Aleph, we have the word, Vayitain lahem achuzah be'eretz Mitzrayim. He gives them an achuzah, a portion in the land of Mitzrayim. And we have that same shorash again in Pasuk Chavzayin at the end, Vayichazu ba. And the question I have to ask is, what is this shorash? What is this achuzah? If you look throughout Tanakh, which is now, if you turn to the next page of your story sheet, I showed you that there are four other places in Tanakh where we have this word achuzah, this is Torah. We can look at those and try to figure out what it means there to try to help us here. If you look in Bereishis Chaf Gimel Chaf, we're talking about the story of Abraham who is buying a plot of land in order to bury his wife Sarah in. And in the story, it's very clear that Ephron tries to offer to him for free. No, he wants to pay for it. Why does he want to pay for it? As the Pasuk tells us, he wants,
Achnzat Kever. He wants this Achnzat Kever for his wife. It seems very similar story. What he wants is this permanent piece of land that he now owns. It's not a land that he's bearing his wife and that he's borrowing. He needs to own that piece of land. And that is the implication of Achnzat. We'll see that in three more places. But Mibrachat Zayin Dalet is discussing the story of Benot Slatzad. Benot Slatzad were a group of sisters who their father died and had no sons. And therefore, when it came time to give out the land of Israel to the Jewish people, they complained to Moshe. And they said, we're not going to get a plot of land because there are no men in the family that are alive. And what are we going to do? And they say to him, Tena lanu achuza b'toch hachayavinu. Give us an achuza. What are they asking? They're not asking for a physical piece of land for them to live on right now. They're asking for a piece of land that will be passed down from generation to generation in their family so that their family will have a plot of land. That's an achuza. By Mibra Lamedet, we have also the same. Reuven and Gad come to Moshe to ask, please, we want to have the piece of land outside of Eretz Yisrael. We don't want to cross into the land of Eretz Yisrael. We want, as they say here, we want this land as an Ahuza. What were they asking for? Again, they weren't asking to live there for a short amount of time. They were asking for that piece of land to be their Nachala, to be where their Shevet is going to live forever and ever. That's what an Ahuza is. And last but not least, in Devarim Lamedet, when God is telling Moshe, stand on the mountain and look over at Eretz Yisrael, he says to him at the end of the pasuk, this is the land that Sheranino obtained of Bnei Yisrael Achuzah. This is the land that I'm going to give the Jewish people as an Achuzah. God, I really hope so, did not intend to give us this piece of land for only a short amount of time. God meant for Eretz Yisrael to be our permanent piece of land that we will always have. And therefore, it seems very clear that Achuzah sounds like a very permanent type of acquiring a piece of land. And that's what the Jewish people had here. They had, not just they were living in this land that wasn't theirs, they kind of had a stake in the land, they owned this piece of land. And now look at the contrast. They have an achuza in the land of Eretz Mitzrayim. The Mitzrayim themselves not only don't own their land because they gave it up to Paro, but they actually are not even living in their own piece of land. They got moved to some other piece of land that they're not even familiar with. So the situation of the Jewish people and the situation of the Egyptians are so different, and the contrast is so clear by the way the story is written and by the details of the story. And of course, the ending of the parak, which are the psukim that we read, shows the major contrast between the two. Which, if you look at Pasuk Chazayin that we had in our sheet, Vayifru Vayirbu Ma'od, the Jewish people multiplied. They were successful. They became many. The Mitzrayim are suffering. They have nothing. They're slaves and they owe nothing. Jewish people are being very successful. And maybe that's the lesson of these psukim, which is God is trying to show us the comparison. If I had just said the Jewish people are doing well, that wouldn't give me the same point as showing to the depths of how bad the Egyptians are doing compared to the status of the Jewish people. And I think this is a lesson that Abar Bunel tries to glean out of the Perek. He says as follows, what is the point of these psukim? I mean, the Mepharshim also asked my question, because it's a difficult thing to understand the significance. And he says, Hinei nachsav kol ha-sipor hazeh b'Torah l'sabor achat. There is one reason for this story. Story in the Torah. Lahodia she'enei Hashem el yirayav u'machalim v'chasta v'chayotam v'rav. To show us that the eyes of God are always on the people who fear. I mean that God protects the Jewish people to make sure that we survive in the famine. Hinei v'yo kol ha'aretz v'rav. Because the entire land is starving. Muflag Yaakov u'beit asud l'kapan chachto. But the family of Yaakov, they are removed from all the horrible things going on, the stealing and the hunger. And when the Mitzrayim are selling all their money and their animals and their bodies and their fields, the Jewish people have everything. They have land, they have everything without having to give up any of their money and without having to give up all of their animals. And then we have a very beautiful lesson that comes out of our parak, which is to show, as Barbara points out, the chesed of Hashem, what he did for us in this situation. Not just we're surviving like everyone else is surviving in the time of the famine, but we are surviving differently than everyone else. We have this unique status where we're doing okay, or we're doing amazing when everyone else is doing so bad. And I think the psukim really point this out even further. If you look back on your story, now you're on page 2, I assume, the psukim seem to parallel that as well. If you look at the repus of Gracious Mem Aleph Nunvav, which is on your sheet, this is an earlier time when the famine begins and the brothers for the first time realize that they have no food and they have to go down to Mitzrayim for the first time. And the pasuk says, "The whole earth bowed Mitzrayim." Like everybody was going down to Mitzrayim. Lishpor et Yosef, ki chazak harav b'chol ha'aretz. That's the language. The famine was strong in the land. But then the brothers go down to Mitzrayim and they get food the first time. Now they run out of food again. Perek Mem Gil, they have to go down again. So the Pasuk tells us, Pasuk Aleph, Baharav Kaved Ba'aretz, the famine was strong in the land again, and now they have to go down to beg from Yosef for a second time. Parallel that to our Perek, and our Perek uses both of those Lashonos, Ki Kaved Harav Ma'od, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, and Pasuk Chav, Ki Chazak Aleim Harav, the same exact language of the strength of the famine, but this time, such a twist. This time, who's running to Yosef and begging him for food and is starving? The Egyptians, not us. We're doing just fine. It's the Egyptians now that have the exact same situation that we had before. And the beauty of that comes out very nicely through the parrot. However, a very ironic thing, if you keep going, however, if you stop here, that's very nice. But if you keep going to Shemos, which we'll get to in a few weeks, the exact situation flips one more time, which is what happens in the beginning of Shemot Perek Aleph. The Egyptians come and they become our masters and we become the slaves and we have nothing and they have everything. And I guess the question that you have to ask is the point of this irony, either again to show God's in control and when God wants us to be doing well, he lets us do well, and when he doesn't, he doesn't. Or I think it's coming maybe to answer a very huge question that everyone has to ask when you get to Shemos. When you get to Shemos, you wonder, what happened? Why all of a sudden do the Egyptians hate us so much that they try to kill all our babies as they're coming out of our bodies, or throw them into the Nile River, or make us all into slaves? Why are they doing this to us? What did we do to deserve this anti-Semitism that they all of a sudden seem to have? And it's very possible that the seeds of that anti-Semitism really started here in this story, which is, we're doing so great, not our fault, but we're doing so great, we're being so successful, and the Egyptians are looking at us saying, we're the ones who donated all our money for the 7 years of plenty in order to make sure that we would have food in the 7 years of famine, and what happened? You didn't donate anything, and you're doing great, and we're doing horribly. That's our food that you're eating, right? And they got very angry, and over time, meaning the time when Yosef is alive, or the influence of Yosef is still around, they can't do anything to us. But that anti-Semitism maybe has begun, and therefore, when it comes time years later, in Shemos, it seems to come out. So we see from here, number one approach is, if you look at the structure of the story, I think very beautifully, the details of the story, comparing to the details of the status of the Jewish people, show us the Yad Hashem, the hand of God that is really going out in this story to help save the Jewish people from hunger. I think that's approach number one. Approach number two that we have to look at is the text itself, meaning not just the structure of the text, but the words in the text. And I think if you look at the paragraph, and you could trust me, but on your sheet, if you want to look through it, I folded and underlined it every time, there is a concept that we have when we learn Tanakh called the Mila Hamadcha, the repeating word. And the repeating word that goes on all the time, over and over again, is normally coming there to hint to us that we should pay attention to something and learn out something from it. We have that throughout Tanakh, like for example, in the story of Migdal Babel, in the story of the Tower of Babel, where we go and we build a tower, we're not really sure why, but all of a sudden God seems to destroy this tower and make us scatter. The word shame sham comes up all the time there, name and there, shame sham. And a lot of Mefarshim bring out from there that maybe the problem there was that we were trying to create a name for ourselves as opposed to the name of God. So here as well, we can take that same methodology and apply it here. If you look throughout the Peret, 11 times the word leparo comes up. That would be very interesting. Paro is not an active figure at all here. He actually does nothing in his entire Peret, in his entire story. But 11 times his name, paro, leparo, everything leparo, given to paro, choka paro, just like paro said over and over and over again. And when you see that, then you have to question, why is it that the Perek is trying to focus us on paro, leparo, leparo? And maybe it's possible to claim that the Perek is trying to, in some way, inform us that the power here is not Yosef. The power here, the person behind all this, is really paro. Paro, in some way, is the one who is just making Yosef do all these things, but really paro is the one who really wants all of this to happen. And you can, if you look back in some of the stories of Yosef, it's very possible to see that earlier on as well. And I gave these sources on a sheet. If you look at Bereishis Mem Hei, Sukkim Yud Zayin to Yud Tet, this is the story when Yosef just revealed to his family that he is Yosef, and he needs in these Sukkim Paro's permission, by Yomer Paro Yosef, tell your family they could come down. Meaning it seems like without Paro saying, let your family come down to Egypt, Yosef couldn't have invited his family down to Egypt. And then the next one that I gave you, Bereishis Mem Zayin Hei through Vav. Paro is the one who gives permission for Yosef's family to live in Goshen. Without Paro, sounds like couldn't have let them live in Goshen. And even to the extent, the next one I gave you, Bereishis Nun, where Paro is the one who has to give Yosef permission to go bury his father. Right at the end, Chapter 12, Yomer Paro, Aleik for Tavicha Tasher, his father. You could go bury your father like you swore. Yosef always needs permission. And therefore, maybe what one could claim is that Yosef, in really, in some ways, is just this person that Paro is using in order to do what he wants to do. In order to examine this a little bit further, I'm just going to take a step back to do a parallel story, which should be next on the sheet. There's a very interesting parallel, we're going to get to more later, between Yosef and actually Haman. We don't normally like to parallel good people with bad people, but the Pesukim seems to parallel very nicely, which I gave to you on your sheet. If you look at Esther Gimel Aleph versus our story, Bereishis Mem Aleph Mem, meaning the choosing of Yosef, just as the appointing of Haman, we have very similar types of stories. Both of them are a nobody or an unknown type person, and all of a sudden, very quickly, get to a great, great status where they're second to that king. All of a sudden, we have in the Megillah, right, all of a sudden, Bachar Debrim Ha'ela, Gizel Hamel Chazashrish, right after he kills Vashti, all of a sudden, Haman becomes this power. But it's a very unique type of power, just like Yosef. Just like by Yosef, we know, if you look at the Pesukim of Bereishis Mem Aleph, I gave you there, Atatiel Beiti, you'll be on top of my house, and your chair will be the highest chair, and only I will be higher than you, everyone will fear you. Same exact lashon is given to Haman, all the servants are going to bow down to you, right? Everyone has to bow down to Haman, and the language is very similar. On top of that, we have a very parallel pasuk, where in Bereishis Mem Aleph Mem Bet, Vayesar Paro et habato me'al yado vayeteinu sal yad Yosef, Paro removes his ring from his hand and gives it to Yosef. So too, in Esther Perek Gimel, Achashverosh Vayesar Hamelch et habato me'al yado vayeteinu Haman. Achashverosh takes off his ring and gives it to Haman, the exact same language. And the question is, what do you do with this parallel? What I wanted to do here with this parallel in order to help us is to bring up this very fascinating idea that I found in the book of Yoshua Bachrach HaGudim Gadorot on Megillas Esther. I'm not going to read it live in your sheet, but I will summarize to you exactly what he says. Yeshua Bachrach has a belief, which is to me a very fascinating belief, that Achashverosh is actually a very intelligent king. Achashverosh, when he first became king, wanted to make sure that he was liked by everyone and that nobody could come and overthrow him or try to kill him. So what does he do in the beginning of the Megillah? He makes this huge party for everyone, right? Hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people come for days upon days, party. Why? He thought that everyone would like me. Everyone comes to my house, I'm sharing all my stuff with them, everyone would like me. What happens right after that? Big ton of terrorists try to kill him. And then he realizes, my plan did not work. I need a new plan to make sure that no one is going to try to overthrow me or no one's going to try to kill me. What does he do? The opposite. He removes himself from the people, puts himself away in the palace where no one can get to him. You're only allowed to speak to the king if he calls you. And if you come to speak to him and he doesn't put out his scepter, you're automatically dead. He becomes very paranoid that somebody's going to come and do something bad to him. But what does he have to do? Who's going to go out there and make the rules and implement the rules? Who's going to do all those things for him if he's hiding away in the palace? Genius. Picks a guy who's his scapegoat. Picks Haman, makes Haman feel all special, puts him in second in command, and Haman does everything Achashverosh wants him to do. What's the goal? The goal is that if anyone gets mad about anything that of the rules that come out, who are they going to associate? Haman. Who are they going to kill? Haman. They'll leave Achashverosh alone. That's his idea when it comes to Haman. I want to associate that idea with Yosef. It's very possible. Paro was in a predicament. Yosef interprets his dreams and says to him, 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Paro has a problem. If he makes a huge deal about what Yosef just did, and he does this whole economical thing, right, and then the 7 years of famine never show up, the people are going to be so angry, we just gave you all of our food for the 7 years of plenty and no famine, right? They're going to be so angry, they're going to get really mad at Paro. If, however, on the other hand, he knows about the famine before and he does nothing, well, then the people are going to get really angry when they're starving because he should have done something. It's a genius idea. I'm going to take the person whose idea it was, and I'm going to build him up. I'm going to say, you be in charge of this project. Achashverosh has nothing to do with this project. When the people come to Achashverosh and they give us food, Paro, come give us food, we're starving. Paro says, go to Yosef, I have nothing to do with it. Paro's nothing, takes himself out completely. So why? Because if it's successful, then he gets the credit. But if it doesn't work out, Yosef is the one who goes for the fall. Very, very smart. But now Paro's working out, looking good. Paro has a better idea. How am I going to get all the power and all the money of my entire kingdom with nobody getting angry at me? I know. I'll make Yosef do it. So he tells Yosef, get all their money, get all their animals, take their fields, take everything. And everything goes, as the parrot says, to Paro. Paro gets everything. But when the people are going to get upset, who's the one doing it? It's Yosef. And the people are going to get mad at Yosef, and Paro's going to be okay. It's an ingenious idea of Paro. However, maybe that's what's going on in our parak, where it's being very clear Yosef is doing everything lip paro to paro. Everything's paro, 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 and it's all about Yosef doing this plan of paro. Of course, that would help us to understand what's the lesson at the end of the day that we would learn from that. So either A, if you do our comparison to Haman, we see that Haman gets corrupted by this, he tries to kill people and do all these horrible things, and Yosef still stays straight person. Or on the other hand, we could go back to the thing that we just discussed a second ago, which is this would totally explain to us why in Shemot Aleph we have a problem. Why all of a sudden the Egyptians hate us. Why do they hate us? Because they associate to Yosef losing everything that they own. Everything is blamed to Yosef. Now, they can't do anything to Yosef. He's protected. He's second to king, right? But that feeling remains, and that feeling gets passed down to children upon children, where all of a sudden later, when they can do something, they will do something about it. So what we see from here is it's possible that that's really what's going on. And I think if you look at the Mefarshim that I gave you on your page, you see this actually makes a lot of sense in what they're trying to say, which is they ask the question, why did Yosef move everyone around? For Yosef, what's the point? Right? There's no reason. But for Paro, there's good reason. What is it? So there's three different ideas I found in the Mefarshim as to why Paro would want Yosef to move everyone around. But Das says as follows. Today Shalotia Nachlatam Bechazakam Harishona. Right? Everyone is now going to be moved into a new nachla. Nachla zen natan lozeh, but nachla zen natan lozeh. I'm going to give you his nachla and you his nachla. Kidei sheyoda ki miparo haita lahem nachlatam. So they will always know this is not our land, right? Well, I'm living in a land that's not mine. So I'll always be reminded that it's paro's. It's not really mine. Always remember that I have to give him one gift. So these are just a reminder always, this land is not mine, it's paro's. Or we move to the Rashbam. Heviro tola arim kemosha sa sancherev. I gave you the next few sources by the psukim of sancherev, which we're not going to go into now, but it's there for you if you want to look at, where sancherev, who was the king of Babel, was this is what he would do to all of his enemies. Everyone he would conquer, he'd move them to different lands. Why, says Rashbam? Kedei shelo yetenu koa chazata ish ish baratzol lachar mechira. So you'd lose the strength of being in your own land. I mean, if you're in your own land, you know the territory, you know where to hide, you know where you can find things, you're familiar, you have friends that you can gather together and revolt with. If you're in a totally different land and you're living with strangers, you can't get together, you're completely weakened by that to make sure that no one revolts. Again, a major advantage for Paro that no one can revolt up against him when he's doing all these things. Ibn Ezra has a third approach. What did power really mean? What does it mean? What did power want Yosef to do? Yosef moved everyone from the city to the farmland so that everybody could work the farm. I mean, Paro, who wants as much money and as much food as possible, but he didn't want the people working and doing whatever. He wanted the people all on the farm. Everyone should be growing. So at the end of the day, it works very nicely with the Mefarshim, which is the goal of what he was doing was really an advantage to Paro. Everything was to make sure that Paro had as much money as possible and had as much things as possible. And maybe, again, that's what's going on in our parak, and that's what the details of our parak to stress to the extent of what Yosef was doing in the name of Paro. However, when you leave that approach, you're slightly irked, I guess. Which is, this is not the picture of Yosef that we're used to. We're used to Yosef the strong and Yosef, you know, the righteous and not this, you know, scapegoat of Paro. So let's look at our parak again. If you look through our parak again, Yosef's name also comes up 11 times, obviously. He is the one who is active in the entire parak and he is the one doing everything in the entire parak. And therefore, maybe we can create a totally different picture of Yosef than the one I just created, which is this parak is about the strength of Yosef. Meaning we started off with Yosef thrown in a pit. Then he gets sold as a slave. Then he gets thrown in jail. It is amazing the extent of what we see of what happened to Yosef. Yes, it was amazing he became second to king, but the details of our story shows the extent to the strength that Yosef had, to the point that he was able to get the entire land of Egypt to be owned by Paro, meaning that was the strength that he had. And it's a very beautiful picture of Yosef, who was able to take himself from this small nothing of just a dreamer to such a strength and such a, you know, high status. And maybe the goal of our parak is really just to praise Yosef, and to show us how strong Yosef is able to become. If you're going to say that, you're going to say to me, well, what about those psukim that you just quoted before about how Yosef couldn't do anything unless Paro gave him permission? Well, I hid from you one pasuk, which is the psukim that I know I gave you on your sheet, in Bereishis Mem Hei Tefri Yud Aleph. This is right after Yosef reveals to his brothers that he is Yosef. And what does he say to them right after he reveals them he's Yosef? Pasuk Tet. Maharuba alu alavi. Go home to my father. Va'amar temela. Ko'amar bincha Yosef. Samani alukim la'adon kol Mitzrayim. Go tell him that his son Yosef is the master of all of Mitzrayim. And here's important for her. Rada Eli, come down to me. Altamo, don't stand around. The Yashafta Be'eretz Goshen, and you will live in the land of Goshen, and on and on and on. Meaning, before Paro said to Yosef, oh, you should bring down your family, and before he said to him, his family should live in Goshen, Yosef already told his family, you should come down and you should live in Goshen. Two ways to look at it. Either he couldn't really do it until Paro gave him permission, or Yosef could do whatever he wants. Yosef's got the power. All he has to do is figure out how to manipulate Paro into saying what he wants him to say. Which we see also much clearer later, which I gave him something there as well, in Bereshit Mem Vav and the beginning of Mem Zayin. Yosef has a whole speech with his family about what they should say when they meet up with Paro. You should say, this is what we do for a living. He only picked five of them, and probably the weakest one. Meaning, Yosef knows how to manipulate Paro. He doesn't want Paro taking his brothers to be in his army or taking his brothers to do something in the palace. He wants Paro to leave his family alone and let them live in Goshen. So he sets up this whole scenario to make sure that what he wants happens. Yes, at the end of the day, Paro has the final say, but Yosef knows how to get his way. He knows how to manipulate Paro when he needs to. It's Yosef the strong. And I think what's very beautiful about Yosef then is we see even though when he reaches this epitome of strength that he has, where he owns Egypt, at the end of the day, back to our parent, what does he do with that strength? He saves the Jewish people. He saves his family. He supports his family, and he's good to his family. And maybe the whole point of our parent is this tremendous praise to Yosef, to show the extent of his power, but yet he still looks out for the Jewish people, and he still associates himself with the Jewish people, which I think you can see some of this in the two mepharshim that I gave you, of Rashi and the Ramban on our parent. Rashi's just talking about the small detail of moving everyone around, but I think we can take what he's saying and apply it to the whole thing. But Rashi says, why is it that Yosef moved all the Egyptians around to live in a different place? Lohutzracha katuv l'ktovzeh. Hasid didn't need to tell us that. That's a detail we don't need to know. El hodiyacha shivcho shal Yosef, tells the praise of Yosef. Shenitzhavein lahasir sarfa me'ar l'chav, shelo yukarin ha'tovolet. He wanted to remove the shame from his brothers that they'll be called strangers. Meaning, if everyone lives in land that they're familiar with, and the brothers live in land that they don't know anyone, then everyone's going to know, those are the new guys, right? However, he moves everyone around, everyone's strangers, so now the brothers can feel very comfortable. And that's a very nice chesed to Rashi. But Rashi seems to be saying that the details of the story seem to be all praise to Yosef, which is the theory that we're doing right now. The Ramban as well. Lahodia ma'alot Yosef b'chachma b'tuin avidas. This parak, this story is telling us praise of Yosef, how great he is in wisdom. Ki haya isha munim shehevi kol ha'kesef bi paro v'lo asa la'atmo oto kesef. And on top of that, we see his honesty and his trustworthy, where he is so trustworthy that everything, all the money he gives to Paro, says right over, all over again, Laparo, Laparo, Laparo. Maybe it's not tells the greatness of Paro, maybe it tells the greatness of Yosef, that everything he did was he gave it over to Paro. He didn't make himself a treasury, says the Ramban, of Al Natan Lamelcha Batechlo, he gives to the Melech, to the king that trusts him, V'matzaba Zechit. And with that, he got the favor of everyone, because he wasn't doing it for himself. He was doing it for Paro. So the Mepharshim seems to point out this next theory of ours, which is maybe the goal of our parak is to show how great Yosef has become, but yet how righteous he still remains, and how he still associates himself with the Jewish people. Or, we can go third possibility, which is we can look at the story and say, yes, Yosef is very strong, and Yosef is very powerful. However, maybe we could say he went a little bit too far. Taking away all the people's money, taking away the people's animals, their land, moving them around to the whole Mitzrayim as slaves, that's not a very productive thing to make the whole land slaves to the king. And maybe what this story is kind of showing us is at the end of all the Yosef story, we're showing Yosef's flaw. We're showing Yosef's slight corruption a little bit when he gets a little bit too crazy in the power and he takes it too much to the extreme where he ends up having, a situation where Paro owns all of Egypt because of him. And this fits very nicely into the history of Yosef himself. Yosef is a child, dreams of having his brothers and his father bow down to him. There's discussion of what he was doing in Mitzrayim when he throws his brothers into jail and then keeps one of them, it puts a goblin in Yama's cup. Ramban points out he's trying to make his dreams come true because he really wants the brothers to bow down to him. And also in the future, we see this very much in the children of Yosef, who are... In the stories of Shoftim, we have many of our Shoftim come from the tribes of Yosef. We have, first Yehoshua is from Ephraim, then we have Deborah from Ephraim, and then we take a switch from Ephraim to Menashe. Gidon is from Menashe, and then Yitzhak is from Menashe, and in both of those situations of Gidon and Yitzhak, the Ephraim people come to complain, how come you didn't invite us into battle? And at the end of Yiftach's time, it becomes such a strong tension between between the two brothers of Yosef, meaning the sons of Yosef, meaning the brothers, Menashe and Ephraim, because they both kind of want this power. There is a civil war that takes place between Menashe and Ephraim where they kill out thousands of their own brother, which is really quite a tragedy. But we see this desire for power in Yosef throughout Tanakh, and therefore maybe that's what we're seeing here, a little bit of a foreshadowing of Yosef's slight flaw that he has. And again, this would make a lot of sense, again, to the creation, as we keep saying, of the infrastructure of Galus Mitzrayim that's coming in the future, would make sense if we're going to say here Yosef went overboard. It would make sense that therefore the Egyptians got upset by this. Now what we need to do is step three. We need to now take a step back and look at the bigger picture of Yosef and try to see which one of these plays in better for our understanding of the story. If you look at the stories of Yosef, there's a very clear picture that is drawn. I gave you on your sheet, Bereishis Lamed Zayim, Sukkim, Vesu Gimel. If you look at Pasuk Gimel first, the Yisrael lo havet Yosef mikol banav. Yaakov loved Yosef from all of his sons. He then took him into... Because he was his son from his old age, he makes him a special coat. Yosef is the favorite child. Very, very clear. Favorite child of his father. He's the one that gets that special coat and walks around with it. The chosen son of the father. On top of that now, if we go back to Pasuk Bet, Elo told us Yaakov Yosef. Very strange Pasuk. Right? These are the generations of Yaakov. Yosef ben Sheva Sheishanach. Yosef is 17 years old and a description of Yosef. Why is that so strange? Well, I gave you next sources, all the times Elo Toldot comes up in Tanakh. Elo Toldot is used in two very different ways. First way that Elo Toldot is used is when it says Elo Toldot, and then lists for us all the children of that person that it just said. So you have Elo Toldot Noah, and the next Pasuk, Shemet Cham Vet Yafet. We have, again, in Yud Pasuk Aleph, Elo Toldot B'nei Noah, Cham Yafet, and then it's Shem Cham and Yafet, and it goes on to tell all of their children, all their generations. Rishis Yidalev, Elo Toldot Terah, Terah has Aram, Nahor, and Haran. Perach HaBalev, Elo Toldot Yishmael, goes on to discuss with us all the children of Yishmael. However, sometimes Elo Toldot really just comes to pick out one child. And that one child is always the chosen child that's going to create the chosen nation. For example, Rishis Yidalev, Yud. Elo Toldot Shem. Shem has Arpach Shad. And then later it tells us the name of his other children. But it lists for us the one person that's important for us to know because that's going to lead us to the Jewish people, to Avraham. Elo told us Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham related to Yitzchak. Avraham had more children than just Yitzchak, but Yitzchak is the chosen child. Elo told us Aaron and Moshe. We only hear the children of Aaron because Aaron's children are the chosen ones in the leadership position. So when you see a pasuk, Elo told us Yaakov, Yosef, you must assume, therefore, the assumption, or at least the intent of Yaakov, and therefore being shown to us in the Pesukim, is that Yaakov thought this is the chosen child, right? He didn't know all his children would be chosen. This is the chosen child. That is the perspective that Yosef begins his life. And we see the favoritism from when he was born. In Bereishis Lamed Chaf Hei, I gave you that pasuk as well, where they're living in Laban's house, and he's having all these children. The moment that Rachel gives birth to Yosef, he goes to Laban and says, Shacheini, send me out. Now I'm going to go. I'm going to go back home. I need my own place, and then leads him to going off to Israel. Or in Bereishis Lamed Gimel, when Yaakov's about to meet up with Esav, and he's terrified, he doesn't know what to do, how does he set up his family? He sets them up in order of how he wants to hide them. Who is in the back of the Pasuk? Rachel and Yosef, Achronim, they're in the back. Being his special and his favorite, he's not hiding it, everyone knows, and everyone probably assumes at that point, this is the chosen son. On top of that, the text of Torah, besides just Yaakov, seems to show us this as well, where we have 13 prakim from the time that we start talking about Yosef in Parak Lamed Zayin until the end of the Sefer. And in all of them, it's the story of Yosef. We go down with Yosef to Mitzrayim, we hear about Mitzrayim. We don't hear about what's going on with the brothers in the meantime, right? We just get caught up. The brothers are starving, so they go down to Yosef. The whole story is about Yosef. And those whole 13 prakim, we only have two prakim where Yosef is not in, and Yosef is not the leader of those prakim. That's the story of Yehuda and Tamar, and that's the story where they all come down to Mitzrayim, because Yosef is already there. The focus of Bereishis is Yosef, up until the ending where I gave you here in Bereishis Perek Nun, the last psukim of Sefer Bereishis is Yosef. All about Yosef. Pasuk Chafet. Vayeshev Yosef in Mitzrayim hu Beit Aviv Vayechi Yosef Me'ev Esar Shanim. He lives for 110 years. He then makes his children swear they're going to take out his bones and bring him to Mitzrayim. Last Pasuk. Vayamat Yosef Ben Me'ev Esar Shanim Vayechantu Oto Vayesem Ba'aron Mitzrayim. Again, it repeats. He lived for 110 years. We know that already. Said it again. And it's the death. That's the final Pasuk of Bereishis. The death of Yosef. Nothing about the brothers. Nothing at all. Not that even that they died. Nothing. All about Yosef. We end Bereishis with really, this is a focus of Yosef. And therefore, if that's the perspective that we're going to have, our parak makes a lot of sense. In the second theory that we brought about Yosef, if our parak is about the praising of Yosef and the strength of Yosef and how he still associates himself with the Jewish people after being in Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, where why didn't he want to just stay and be Egyptian? Why did he care to become part of the Jewish people? This is the sefer of Yosef. The ending of the story is the sefer of Yosef. And therefore, a praise, a parak about the praise of Yosef is very true. However, we're going to take the other perspective. I think you can also see this very differently, which is when you get to the end of Bereishis, you think this is Yosef, the sefer of Yosef, the chosen Yosef. What happens when you get to Bereishis Mem Tet? Yaakov gives brachot to everybody. Everybody's chosen, not just Yosef. And not just that, who gets the best bracha? Who gets the leadership bracha, the king bracha? Yehuda. Shocking! Shocking ending. Yaakov loves Yosef, favorite son, beginning to end, king of Egypt, leader, par excellence, doesn't get it. And then you wonder, somehow he's rejected. Somehow he lost that status of being the leader. How did he lose it? And maybe our story is the answer to that question. How did he lose it? He lost it because he went too overboard. He went too much. We saw that he gets slightly corrupted by this power, and therefore if he's going to get corrupted by the power, he's not a good leader for the Jewish people. On the other hand, we can do a combination of the two, make everybody happy. We can say as follows, Yosef's a good leader. We see his strength. We see everything that's very good about him. And therefore, he is a leader throughout the Jewish people, throughout history. Right? As I said before, Yehoshua from Yosef, majority of the Shoftim from Yosef. After the Melucha, David gets overthrown in the time of Shlomo, Yerubam from Yosef, right? Yosef is throughout our history. However, who is the leader? Yehuda. Who is second leader? Yosef. Why is Yehuda the leader? He's the one that gets the respect of the brothers. He's the one that's able to stand up to Yosef and make him cry and give in, right? He's the stronger of the two. He should be the leader. But Yosef's number two. He's not rejected. He's number two. And he's number two throughout. He's number two to Paro. He's number two throughout our history. And very nice ending, he's very number two in the time of Mashiach as well. We have Mashiach ben Yosef, who's then going to be followed by the Mashiach ben David. Yosef is the number two. He's not the rejected. He's the powerful. He's strong. He's great. But he has flaws. And therefore, he's our number two. Which would be a very nice way to put together all the stories of Yosef. Step number three. Step number four. So we're up to now. How about parallel stories? We have two stories in Torah, or I would say Tanakh, that are so similar to the stories of Yosef. And you have all the psukim there in front of you. We're not going to be able to read all the psukim, but you can follow along with me as I go through them. The two people that parallel Yosef the most is Mordechai and Daniel. Those are the two people, which of course is not a coincidence that all of them are people who are in Golos, right, and become, befriend in some way, or become the high officer in the king's palace, and therefore are able to help the Jewish people in a major way, and to help save the Jewish people in lots of times, or make their lives better where they're living. That's the goal of all three of these stories. Let's just do a little bit comparison of all of them. If you look, Mordechai versus Yosef, very similar as well. That story of the king taking off the ring and giving it to Yosef, which we parallel to Haman before, we have the exact parallel to Mordechai as well. We already read the story by Yosef, so now I'll just read Esther Chetzet. Vayasar ha-melech ha-tabato, asher ha-vir mi-haman, vayisnam ha-mordechai. Very ironic, the ring that he took off of Haman, he now gives to Mordechai, which very nicely parallels Paro giving his ring to Yosef. We also have both of them getting dressed up in kingly garb and being treated as a king. We have in Bereishis Mem Aleph, vayalbeish oto b'seishesh, vayisem revit ha-zahav ha-chavaro, kingly garb that Yosef is wearing. So too in Esther Ches Tedvav, u-mordechai yatsam al-lefnei ha-melech v'lubush ma-chut, and then the pasuk goes on to describe his kingly clothes that he is wearing. Both of them get put on chariots and have somebody, you know, walking around leading the chariot, screaming something about them. We have a gracious memorial and gimel by our tabletop of their kevin hamishneh asher lo. But you prove upon them avarech from the Torah to Alchemist Ryan. They led him in the chariot, screaming, "This is the person who is now in charge, put in charge of Mitzrayim." So too in Esther, very famous that we all know. They put Haman puts Mordechai on the chariot and leads him around screaming, same language, but Yekivehu, he puts him on top of the chariot and then screams Lefanav again, the same language, this is what the king does to someone that he wants to honor. The description of their power is also very similar. If you look at the Pesukim, Bereishis Mem Aleph Mem Aleph Vayomer Paro El Yosef Rei Natati Otcha L'Eretz Mitzrayim, I put you in charge of the land of Mitzrayim. So to an Esther, Mordechai gets put in charge of the house of Haman, not as much, but still similar. Bereishis Mem Aleph Mem Dalet, we have the discussion of the fear and the respect that everyone else, even the officers in the palace, have to have for Yosef, which we have as well in Esther Tet Gimel, Ki Nafal Pachad Mordechai Lehem, the fear of Mordechai is on all the people. They both have very interesting psukim where after they get this power, they go out in some sort of ceremonious way to the people. We have the Yetzei Yosef Melefnei Paro, just like Mordechai Yatsa Melefnei Hamelech. So we have very similar people, and of course the biggest similarity between them is they both save the Jewish people, right? Without Yosef, we would have starved, and without Mordechai, we would have been killed from the decree of Haman. A very interesting just side point to make is that at the end of the Megillah, we have this one pasuk that doesn't seem to make any sense whatsoever. If you look at Esther Perek Yud, pasuk Aleph, Vayasem HaMelech Achashverosh Mas Ala Aretz V'yei Hayam. Achashverosh puts a tax on the people. And then the pasuk goes on to about Mordechai. What does that have anything to do with us? If you look at the Farshim there, the Malbim there says, well, it shows the influence of Mordechai, how he was able to establish, that Achashverosh was able to conquer so many countries and therefore be able to tax them. And that says that directly parallels us, which is our story of Yosef being able to get money and tax and get strength for Paro. And therefore, if that's the highlight of the ending of the Megillah, so to us, which is the strength and ability of our hero, of Yosef and of Mordechai. However, Yeshua Bachrach takes the opposite approach, which we also did for Yosef, which is he says, no, the taxing is a negative. Achashverosh got so greedy, he taxed them, and he shouldn't have taxed them, he taxed his own people. So too, that was parallel to our ending of Yosef, which is Yosef getting a little bit greedy at the end and taxing when he shouldn't. But at the end of the day, I think the significance of the parallel for sure is Pasuk Gimel that I gave you here, Esther Yud, Pasuk Gimel, Ki Mordechai Yuzi Mishneh L'Malach Achashverosh V'Gadol La'Yuzim V'Ratzui L'Rog Echad Dorish Tov La'Amo V'Dover Shalom L'Chol Dara. Yes, he was the officer of the king. Yes, he had his power. But what did he do with it? He made sure there was peace for the Jewish people. He made sure that things were good for the Jewish people. So too Yosef as well in our psukim. The parallel to Daniel is also extremely strong. Daniel also is someone who is in Gullah. And he is able, just like Yosef, to bring himself up to he's a captive, he's a nobody, to bring himself up to be the second to king or the advisor of the king. Both of them have similar personalities. In the first parallel that I made for you here, Daniel has Vayitena Lukim Chesed over Racham. I mean, people saw Daniel and they just liked him. And that we see about Yosef all the time. You say Yosef Chayin Beinav, we're talking about Potiphar and in jail, and even at the end of our story, Yosef just had a very likable type of personality, which seems to be the same in Daniel. But the biggest similarity that Daniel also, as the psukim go on, he understood dreams. He had his own dreams and interpreted his own dreams just like Yosef did, but even more so, he gets stood in front of the king and he interprets the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar just like Yosef interprets the dreams of Paro. And very similar stories where we have the servant of Nebuchadnezzar, Arioch, who comes to Nebuchadnezzar and says, I know a kid who's in captive and he knows how to interpret dreams. Why don't I have him come interpret your dream? Because Nebuchadnezzar, same language, was very upset with Tipa Eim Rucho from the fact that he had this dream that he could interpret. Exactly like Paro. We have the Sarah Mashkim, who after again, it's the same words of power being so upset by his dreams. So Amashim pipes up, oh, we have a guy who's in jail who knows how to interpret dreams. And they got brought out to Paro. And both of them, I mean, I'm not reading the Sukkim inside so much because Daniel's in Aramaic, so the parallel would be much more difficult. So I did give you, I believe, English translation for all the Aramaic. But in Daniel as well, we have it after he interprets the dream. The response of Nebuchadnezzar is, wow, what a wise person. He is godly, meaning his wisdom is from Hashem. Just like we have by Paro, where he says that this person has Ruach Elokim bo, meaning not only just do they get the respect from their wisdom, but they both in some ways influence the king to understand that God is involved in this process and God really is what's in charge of what's going on. I mean, the parallels between them are actually incredible. But at the end of the day, all three of them have an amazing similarity. which is they go from nothings to being extremely important people in the palace, and at the end of the day, the people that they look out for are the Jewish people, not just for themselves and not for their own power. And maybe that, again, is the focus of our story here, to teach us the proper way for the Jew in Golos who gets to put himself in the powerful position should act and what his priorities should be. Or on top of that, seeing how they were able to infuse God into Paro or into the king and for him to have some sort of understanding that God is also involved. Last but not least, I have one more approach that I want to discuss, which is what I would call the historical approach. I gave you an excerpt from Nachum Sarna, which again, I'm not going to read inside with you, but you can read it. Where Nachum Sarna basically has an assumption. He's a historian. And he says that around the time of the 16th century BCE, where a lot of the scholars place the story of Yosef, there was a major event that happened in Egyptian history. The Hyksos took over power in Egypt, and they ruled over Egypt. And sometime during that rule, a major movement began where northern Egypt and southern Egypt became united. And it was a major event in Egyptian history, because Egypt at the time was the most powerful country in the world, and they united as one, and that's never happened before, and it was one of the most major events of Egyptian history. And they placed it around the time of Yosef. And therefore, one can maybe argue that that is what our parak is about. What is our parak about? It's about Yosef taking people from one end of the border and moving them to the other end of the border, and the other end of the border moving them to that end. What's he doing? He's uniting Egypt. And maybe in that sense, the story that we have here is written because it is one of the most fundamental and most important stories of Egyptian history. And for sure Tanakh records important and fundamental historical events. So we have that in Bereishis Yudalit, the war of the four and five kings with Abraham. The four kings are fighting the five kings. If you look at the map, that's the entire almost world at the time that's fighting with each other. Of course that gets recorded, and that also gets like 10 psukim as well, to tell us the exact events of how many years they fought and how many years they revolted and exactly what was going on. Because a major historical event of history where all of a sudden a Jewish person becomes involved, Abraham, and is able to totally change the events of history, where instead of the four most powerful kings winning, the five kings, who are just these little people in the corner, are able to overthrow them, that's huge. So to hear, what's our story? We have a Jewish person, a single Jewish person, who is able to have a major effect on Egyptian history. Maybe he doesn't do the whole thing, but he starts the process of uniting the northern and the southern part of Egypt, which is, again, the most major historical event of Egyptian history. And therefore, maybe that's what makes this so important, which is the ending of our story is showing, wow, look what Yosef did. He didn't just give everything to Paro. He was able to unite Egypt and change the course of Egyptian history. At the end of the day, what we've done here is we had a bunch of different approaches, four different approaches that we took to come out with a bunch of different theories. Either what we said is, let's look at the structure, and through the structure we saw that there's a comparison of what's happening to the Egyptians to what's happening to the Jewish people. In that sense, we're able to understand God's hand and Yad Hashem and get the message of how amazing God was to us. Or number two is to show us that maybe this is the beginning of the anti-Semitism because there was such a stark difference between what's going on at the time of the Egyptians to us, and therefore they were angry at us for what was going on. Or maybe it's to teach us about Yosef. Either it's to teach us how he's really just a puppet to Paro, and he really isn't this major player in Egyptian history, and again, how that would create the anti-Semitism because they're always going to blame Yosef for everything that went on. Or to show how great and wonderful Yosef was and how strong he was and how yet he still associated himself with the Jewish people. Or on the other hand, to show the flaw of Yosef, which we're going to therefore see in the rest of Yosef's history, that he gets corrupted by power and therefore understanding why he's not the main leader of the Jewish people, but yet the lesser leader, the second to leader after Yehuda. Or we looked at parallel stories where we saw based on parallels to Mordechai and Daniel, we see to learn from Yosef how a Jew in Golos who has power is supposed to act and how, again, his priority is supposed to be to help the Jewish people and also the effect that he is able to have on other countries as well. Or the historical approach where to show that Yosef was able to affect, possibly, if we place him at this time, the history of his time and to be able to make such a major effect of uniting the greatest country in the world, and that a Jew was able to do something that an Egyptian king probably had tried to do for years, and he was able to pull that off. Thank you for inviting me.
You should go off.
Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
Mordechai was also a descendant of
Binyamin, right? So it's also Bnei Rachel. Is Daniel also part of that? Or is that
Daniel
like
is from Yehuda.
Oh.
I mean, I actually, if I had more time, I have a different year where I actually trace all the Shvatim from the beginning, develop their personalities, and show how they
wow.
show throughout.
Is that Daniel, recorded? On Y? Is that on YU Torah at all? Is that sure?
I think it is.
So it'd
but,
be under your name.
Yeah, okay. But I'm saying Daniel has the strength of Yehuda. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, yes, in some sense, I always read through, and there are a few people I wish were from other tribes who fit it better. And they both, but both of them fit within their, I mean, Binyamin is a very passive character, the one who embraces and never hears sound. I hear a word out of Binyamin. So too, Esther and Mordechai are very passive and quiet until they're forced to move out of their passivity. Because Shaul is also from Binyamin, very passive. So that does fit as well. Daniel has the strength. I mean, he is able to stand up numerous times, you know, through the lion's den and through the many times that people try to take him down and the other officers that are jealous and they try to get rid of him, he has that strength of Yehuda. So it does fit, even though, yeah, it would be nice in some sense. But yeah, you're right. You know, Mordechai fits in that. Binyamin and Yosef do share a lot of the same characteristics because they do come from Rachel as well. So yeah, I agree. Yeah.
First of all, I want to talk about how much you can say and how close to those it is. I just want to say there is another way of looking at it. First of all, Birkat Yaakov, what does that mean so that Israel would be the leader of Nevuah? One can say that. And the other thing is, it's not like Yehuda, when he changed, first of all, Yehuda had some corruption in his life
for sure.
Falling. And secondly, once he had the power of Yosef, his descendants, there was plenty of corruption there. It wasn't like it was limited to Yosef and that he got corrupted by power. Because you know most of the Luffins were corrupt.
And most of them are from Yosef.
What?
Most of them are from Yosef.
No. From Yehuda as well.
I mean, the difference, let's just respond. A lot of the corruption that we have in Malachim is serving the Lord of God, not necessarily trying to take money of people and wanting power.
And you know, the Shlomo
attaches
to people so badly.
And then Rechava makes it even worse. 100%. Meaning, you're not going to say that every single corrupt person we're going to put to Yosef, for sure. Meaning, in every type of personality case, there are people who are going to break out and have a different personality. Yehuda, as you mentioned, he for sure has a flaw. His flaw is women, which we see in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. And we see that throughout. David has a Bathsheba problem. Shlomo has too many women problems, right? Throughout all the women problems in history, Ruth, right? All Yehuda people. And that problem comes throughout. And it's actually fascinating that the flaw of Yehuda is the strength of Yosef. He's able to withstand Eshet Potiphar. But the flaw of Yosef is also the strength of Yehuda, because normally we don't see Yehuda stepping in unless he has to. And he's much stronger than Yosef. Yosef breaks down and cries numerous times. Yehuda never breaks. So they complement each other, which is why I think they're number one and number two, because they're supposed to be together, because they do complement each other. So, yeah.
How do you justify the fact that Yosef becomes this great leader, that he takes care of his family, that he's obviously his we bless our sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, because they grew up in Egypt in the midst of all the Avodah Zarah and yet remain Jewish. But he married a woman who isn't Jewish.
Moshe also marries Zipporah, who's from Midian, and then the Isha Kushit, which we don't know who she is, maybe another one. So that doesn't seem to be the biggest flaw in history. If you look throughout all the times where we have people marrying wrong people, like Shimshon or Shlomo marries lots of countries' daughters to make peace with them, the issue is not the marrying. The issue is the effect that they have on you. And the fact that they make them serve Avodah Zarah or do bad things. That's normally the problem with marrying outside. If you look at the Pesukim where it says, don't marry outside, except for the few nations that were never supposed to marry outside of, but Canaan is because you'll learn from their toiva, right? But here in this situation, Yosef, number one, was forced to marry this woman. I don't think he really got a choice when he became the king of Egypt. But the point is that even when married to this woman, she had no effect on him whatsoever. We hear her name once. We never hear of her again. Her effect on him never manifested in any way, and therefore he remained Jewish within himself. And that's what's most impressive. Meaning, Shlomo even got slightly corrupted, seemingly according to the text, by his wife, or was having a Avodah Zarah going on in his home, if not yet that he was serving himself. But Yosef, none of that. We don't see any of that within Yosef, and I think that is very praiseworthy. Yeah?
And the Midrash says she was Batina.
And the Midrash says she was Batina, so she's really Jewish, and she was also going by a fake name. Gosh, yeah.
Two things. First of all, this to support your second in command. Yosef
being second, right? Yosef was like the entire the other thing I was wondering when I was looking at the first the parak that you cited, the Kohanim are the ones that have land. It's the exact opposite of what we have now in North Israel. I was just wondering whether or not kind of we learn from that, if there's something that we can.
I mean, there are some portions that you point out that, you know, that we learn from this parak, and it's just a pasuk within the parak, and we can do everything, but that we learn out from there, like the Kohanim, you know, the importance that one should give to the Kohanim, just like that we have that in Judaism. I don't know if I've ever seen, I don't just remember anyone inside who's saying, you know, we're the opposite of that. But it's a very nice concept, which is their Kohanim, you know, they get special portions, special piece of land. Our Kohanim, they have to live off of us, and we have to provide for them, not the king. You know, we have to make sure they live in a nachla within our nachla, and we have to give them truma, and we have to support them, which is a very different relationship than that.
And the other thing I was thinking of is that Yosef married the daughter of Cohen, right?
Yeah.
And so he's looking out for them, and he's also looking out for, in other words, he's looking out for all his people, all his connections.
Okay, that's nice. I never thought that way. Meaning, if it's true that this, I mean, even though it sounds like because Paro was the one who gave him this portion, but Yosef's obviously respecting that. I don't know if he could go against Paro, but that's a nice idea that Kohen is his wife's side and we're his other side. But of course, the significance in the pasuk is about the way he treated us. Meaning, it doesn't say he supports them, it just says he leaves them alone. So then we see them like one step down from what he does for us. Yeah.
After Paro, you know, Joseph does the interpretation of the dreams and Paro with his friends at number two, he says, I'm very interested. They meet the Yosef when he slay Paro by a Goro before Harvest. That's right. He left the fort and went out in the country. Well, of course, you say he has to go to see what's going on. But also, I thought it was very interesting, the idea that he doesn't want to just stay in the fort. Like all the other quarters just seem to hang around.
He doesn't want the input.
He wants to see what's going on with this way of a technique of leadership, because we have so many times we see our leaders are so insulated, isolated. They don't know what's going on with their leaders.
No, it's a very good point. I mean, one point is that he doesn't want to stay within the palace walls, maybe he doesn't want the influence of the palace walls. But on top of that, you're right, we see Shmuel, why he was such a successful judge, is because he went around from place to place to check out the people. So that's very nice what you're saying about Yosef, which is he went out to the people, and that's why he was so successful.
And we have both humble origins.
I was just going to say, I thought it was interesting, I mean, this approach to Yosef and Paro's relationship, that you could see it either as, you know, Paro really has all the power to scapegoat Yosef, or that Yosef really does have his power, but I think there's kind of a third way, which is that Yosef is no fool, and that he knows that Paro is scapegoating him, so that every chance he gets, he says, oh, this is for Paro, and this is for Paro, and this is for Paro. Like, it's a way to, yes, he's being placed in that position, but at the same time,
he's
always, you know, it's like, you're going to play me, but I'm going to play you right back. And, of course, there's nothing, you know, you could say it, you know, with a totally straight face, well, I'm doing this for Paro, which... They're both kind of serving each other's.
No, I like that. Very nice. I mean, I think in the Megillah you could do the same. Haman to Ahasuerus, it could be Haman is the genius, Ahasuerus is the, you know, the idiot, I guess. Or it could be that Haman is the one being used by Ahasuerus, which, right, there's also the combination. Always combinations work nicely. This too. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.